Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nicholas Investment Insights. We have another special guest this week in Susan Farquhar. Susan is one of the country's leading experts in investment property and is managing director of Calla Property, who specialise in helping everyday Australians make smarter decisions when choosing to invest in property. Through her decades of investing and helping others invest in Australian property, Susan sits in the perfect position to provide some serious insight into the current state of Australia's favourite asset class. She also offers some terrific viewpoints on how you can maximise your chances of success when selecting such a long-term asset. After the interview, we'll then look at some of the wider investment implications that these themes can impact on how we invest money every day here at Nucleus Wealth. So join Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen, and myself, Tim Fuller, as we dive into a fascinating hour with a thought leader at the very coalface of the average Australian's biggest asset class. I hope you enjoy. Today on the show, we are very fortunate to have award-winning entrepreneur, educational blogger, and managing director of Calla Property, which currently sits in the top 10 property specialists in Australia. Susan Farquhar, welcome to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. So look, just to get us started, I thought maybe we might just ask for a little bit of background about yourself and your company, of course, sitting in the top 10 property specialists. We need to know about that. Would you mind just sort of, for our listeners, just providing a bit of insight on your background?
Yeah, sure. So look, for the last over 15 years, I've been developing a research methodology that uses 130 points of criteria to consistently identify the right property in the right place at the right time for our busy property investors. This is Australia-wide research, and it's a free service that we offer our clients. And I'm able to do that because I'm just very passionate about making sure that when people are investing in property, they get it right the first time. Unfortunately, I learnt the wrong way, where I invested in the wrong property in the wrong place at the wrong time, not once, not twice, but five times over. So I had five properties by the time I was 26, and I just really had no idea what I was doing and had built a very unstable portfolio. So when things became unstable in my life and I had to really look at freeing up some capital and getting some cash flow happening, they were the first things to fall over. You know, there weren't properties, solid properties that I could leverage or that provided any kind of safety net. If anything, I was hemorrhaging cash because I really just didn't know what I was doing. So I have since got qualifications in financial planning. I have an MBA in finance. I'm also qualified as a mortgage broker and real estate agent. That has given me a very solid foundation in understanding what it really means to be an investor, what a solid investment looks like. And when it comes to property, when I sort of started looking at property again and going, well, this is the right asset class for me, but, you know, how do I do this better? I started with about 20 points of research, and that has just grown over time as I've learned more and more, you know, as I continue my journey, and that's grown to around 130 points. So,
So just to give our listeners sort of a bit of a colour for the types of things you look at.
Okay, so we start with the macro research. So the macro research is the research that points us in the capital city or region that's set for strong capital growth. So the main drivers of growth for a region or capital city are, well, we start with the economy. So we need to have a strong and diversified economy. We don't look at populations under 100,000 people because that speaks to the economy. We look at the demographics of the population. We look at infrastructure projects. We also look at supply and demand from a macro perspective. So when you look at supply and demand from a micro point, it's really expressed in the vacancy rate. From a macro perspective, it's really access to finance. So before a fall and before a rise, there are significant changes to financial policy and access. And we're seeing that now in Sydney and Melbourne. You know, the clock is starting to kind of swing around after two interest rate cuts and a change to the assessment rate by the banks. And, of course, the Royal Banking Commission is, you know, sort of coming to an end. So They're the main areas that we look at that help us understand what areas are set for strong capital growth. Then we drill down further using micro indicators to find the right property in the right place. So the macro is about getting the right funding. The right company in the right place is really understanding who is going to be renting your property and what kind of property are they going to value. So if you're looking at, say, you know, Brunswick, for example, or Surry Hills, investing in a big house is maybe not going to be the best investment. It probably won't give you the best returns than if you're investing in, say, a one-bedroom apartment. And then if you look at who's going to be renting there, well, there's a lot of students, doctors, nurses, young professionals, hipsters, you know, a whole range of singles and couples. And then look at what they're going to need. You know, they're probably not going to need a double lockout garage, right? But they are probably going to value having a bicycle or being close to public transport. So they're the sorts of, in the micro research, we're looking at the amenities, transport, and we also look at a whole lot of other things that are relevant to the particular property that we find once we've found it. And they're things like crime statistics, social housing, flood, fire, you know, a whole range of other things that then help us understand what makes for, you know, what is the best property that we can find for our investors once we've found the right suburb in the right capital city or the right area in the region.
Yeah, sounds good. And so in terms of the macro side, I guess what changes have you seen over the last sort of 24 months, I guess, maybe starting with the Royal Commission? Obviously there was a tightening in lending standards as that happened. Can you sort of, I guess, walk through from your perspective the effects you saw that had on the property market and then most recent changes?
Yeah, so look, any changes to finance are usually fairly directed towards the investors. What happens is the market starts to rise. There is a lot of political discussion around first home owners and affordability of housing for our young people. So we then start to look at policies that might make it a bit of an easier landscape for first home owners to get into. So governments and, you know, various boards get together and discuss, you know, what are the things that can encourage first home owners in? So things like stamp duty concessions, or first homeowners grants for first home buyers. But they're simultaneously looking at finding ways that can dissuade investors from that market. So changes again to stamp duty concessions. So you saw that in Melbourne, for example, where investors used to get massive stamp duty concessions for buying new property. That changed on the 1st of July 2017, I think. And so that dissuaded investors from that market, which allowed the Melbourne cycle to continue for quite a bit longer than the Sydney one. Other changes are changes to Foreign Investment Review Board. So if you look at the stamp duty that foreigners are charged compared to locals, so that's sort of one segment of the investor market that we can try to kick out. But then we also look at things like changes to banking policy. So interest-only loans compared to principal and interest loans, LVRs, assessment rate, but particularly looking at where they are penalising investors. So where the interest-only rate will be significantly higher than a principal and interest rate, or you're not allowed to borrow more than 80% as an interest-only loan. So typically investors want to borrow as much money as they can for as little money as possible. So they're wanting to borrow, say, 90% on an interest-only loan, and that's typically how investors build portfolios fairly quickly. So these are all policies that are encouraged to dissuade investors in particular and simultaneously encourage first homeowners into a certain marketplace. And then when you look at the Royal Banking Commission, where APRA got involved and, you know, looked at the assessment rate, I mean, I remember about 20 years ago, NAB being one of the first banks that had a policy that had an assessment rate significantly higher than the actual rate. And that was a way of protecting their loan book. And then, you know, APRA's got involved and that assessment rate hasn't changed for a long time, even though our interest rate has been dropping, you know, significantly in, just in the last 6 years. So to have an assessment rate that is greater than 2% higher than the average, you know, comparative rate is kind of, you know, building in a little bit too much of that. And then banks are also looking at, you know, looking at the expenses for home loans in really, really critical terms, you know, like really going through people's credit card statements with a fine-tooth comb rather than having sort of a table that is a generalization for what, say, a couple or two kids might spend. You know, to the point where I was speaking to my mortgage broker and she was doing a loan for a really solid client, and in the previous 3 months of credit card statements that the bank required, they found one single transaction at a pet store for $49.95, and then they wanted to see another 3 months of credit card statements to assess whether there was actually a pet in her ownership, because if there was a pet, then that was another mouth to feed. As it turns out, this client had actually just bought a present for a friend who loves a dog, but that's the level, you know, the banks are going at. And it's just ridiculous, and it makes lending very, very difficult for, you know, for that big contact.
And I mean, I guess we saw that type of assessment sort of middle of the financial crisis. And I guess typically you'd usually see, I guess the way we think about credit cycle is you typically usually see that banks get out there and lend freely, and then, you know, and the party gets going a bit too hard, and then you hit the top of the cycle and you start getting a few loan losses, and then all of a sudden the banks suddenly realize, hey, that's right, you know, that these things can fall over, and they all start pulling back their credit all at the same time, which then makes everything worse sort of on the way down. Yeah, but this time was a bit different. Like, it wasn't, because it was sort of it was driven by the Royal Commission more so than actually seeing the loan losses and sort of and hitting that peak debt stage. It almost feels as if that whole cycle was sort of cut off halfway through and well, not maybe not halfway through, but, you know, cut off a lot earlier than it would have gone to if you'd sort of given its natural progression, and then it would have fallen a lot harder as well. Is that sort of the type of and so now we're seeing this credit freeing up again, or starting to free up, without having sort of seen a full up and a full down cycle? Is that how you'd characterize it as well, or do you see it differently?
I think the Royal Banking Commission obviously has had a significant effect. But I wouldn't say that it was counter-cyclical, or that it wasn't kind of, you know, before its time, before the markets dropped. I think that there, you know, if you look at, say, the way we map the property, property as an asset class on the asset clock, and you can use that, you know, we call it the property clock, but, you know, you can call it a shares clock, or, you know, foreign exchange clock, whatever you like, you know, and there are different, you know, indicators. For the property clock, if you're looking at, say, between 9 and 12, we call that the growth quadrant. And just before 12, there's usually quite a lot of building activity. And I think in Sydney and Melbourne there, and in Brisbane as well, there was, you know, a significant amount of oversupply that was ready for a correction. So I wouldn't say that it was premature or that it cut the cycle short. I think that, especially in Sydney, I think that the property prices were really getting up there, like, you know, extraordinary, you know, millions and millions of dollars for something that is not actually inherently worth that amount of money. As well as seeing this huge amount of oversupply in pretty much in Sydney and Melbourne in every, activity centre, from the CBD to all of the satellite activity centres, there's definitely oversupply. So I don't know that it was premature. I think it pretty much coincided. And in actual fact, just before the market dropped, APRA said, okay, we won't make the mistake of getting involved in monetary policy again, which they have. or banking policy rather, not monetary policy, but banking policy. So, and I think the fact that them pulling away from that didn't coincide with the market suddenly rallying, you know, if they still went in, they're still going into correction, and now I think going into the trough and the decline would sort of indicate that. That's just from a property perspective, though. I don't know if that's the case with other, you know, other asset classes.
Yeah, sure. And I guess so. I mean, from a, I guess generally speaking, in property, and maybe actually this is sort of getting, this is probably opening a can of worms that might be too large for this for this one. But generally speaking, you would expect that in a property cycle, you can sort of at the peak of the cycle, they go through that part where, at the start of the cycle, and it starts where people can borrow money and make a return on that money from the rent, and then the capital growth sort of helps tick them along, and then the property values go up a bit more, and then now you can no longer make a return, and it's all about the capital gain, and in other asset classes, they call that the Ponzi finance stage of it, where you're basically buying an asset, you're losing money on it, and you're just relying on the fact that the capital will go up to sort of bail you out. And so ordinarily, I guess, or certainly in other countries, when properties go through the cycle, they sort of, at the bottom of it, you're back to the stage where, yes, I can buy something, and the average property I buy will pay for itself. And then, you know, the capital gains is sort of a plus on top of it. Whereas where we are now sort of peaking, where we are now sort of bottoming out, I don't think it would be true that the average property would be paying for itself. Is that how you would see it? I mean, I know there's obviously special cases out there.
I think it just depends on what market. You know, I think in a low interest rate environment like we're in now, it's pretty easy for properties to pay for itself. You know, like what we really specialize at Keller Property is demonstrating the cash flow both before and after tax, on a very high level. You know, like obviously that's the job of an accountant and financial planner to do that in more detail, but just to look at how the property performs. Generally, the properties that we recommend, because this is Australia-wide research, we are looking for properties that have a balance between rental yield and capital growth. In most cases, we find outside of super, so as long as you're not investing in SMSF where you require a greater deposit and it's a much higher rate, we find that the cash flow is fairly neutral. So, and going back.
Yes. Yeah, sorry. I guess that's where I'm coming from is I'm saying. So you're saying the best properties at the moment, or the ones you can find, and I'll argue the same when the stock market's overvalued as well, is that I can still go in and find some stocks that are still going to perform. But I will say the average stock is not giving a high enough return. And I guess that's what I'm coming back to in that property market is if you're saying the best properties you can find are giving you a neutral return on that or potentially a little bit positive. Because I guess what I'm thinking is, you know, if you're paying on a mortgage, you're paying 4%-ish, 3.5% to 4%. And net yield, the average net yield in Sydney the average gross yield in Sydney is 2% or 3%. Yeah, so 3%. So the net yield is probably 1%.
So we very rarely recommend properties in Sydney for that reason. So we're looking at growth areas in regional towns. In Brisbane is set for strong capital growth. Sunshine Coast, and those rental yields tend to be closer to 5%, and in some cases even higher, 6%. But we tend to play in that 4.5% to 5.5% space. Because that has a correlating effect with the capital growth that we can expect too. And just going back to the timing of this, if you really getting the timing for property is critical, but really only for the first cycle. You know, you really want to make sure that you're getting that upswing in the first 3 to 5 years because that will insulate your property against shocks on the way down. But after that first cycle of 7 to 10 years, it's really compound interest that's doing the heavy lifting when it comes to property.
Fascinating. Just interestingly, there when you you spoke about the was it 130 odd step research project, which sounds fascinating in itself. For one, that kind of lends itself to a more sort of quantitative approach. So what you're really trying to do is ascertain quality in, you know, potentially lower value markets. You mentioned before that you sort of, you know, you steer clear of Sydney because of that, as Damien yourself mentioned, that sort of 1% yield trap almost. And so instead you're sort of looking further out, but then of course a lot more work's required to make sure that you're not, you know, as you said at the start there, you know, picking the wrong properties and being stuck with them as well. Exactly.
There's also, just in your question also, there's a bias inherent in your question, and that is that Sydney and Melbourne outperform pretty much every other market. Even in the last cycle where Sydney had enormous gains, there were 20 regional towns in Australia that did better than Sydney just in capital growth. So,
And so what were some of the examples or reasons behind those?
Well, Geelong is a great example that you guys are probably more familiar with. You know, in Geelong, you've got the City of Melbourne very actively looking to, get the heat out of Melbourne because it is it's constrained. You know, like you don't have the same constraints as Sydney in terms of, you know, the Great Dividing Range and, you know, this massive ocean and massive river system through, you know, half of the city, as well as national parks north and south. You know, Sydney is far more constrained and far more difficult to extend its reach than Melbourne is. Where Sydney is built on sandstone, so even though it's easy to get through sandstone, it's full of layers of water, which create another whole issue. Whereas Melbourne is built on rock that comes from cooled lava flows. So it's very, very hard, but it's very, very stable. So it's much, much easier for you guys to just chuck another 16 suburbs north of Melbourne, which you've done, right? So saying that, it's still catching up the infrastructure that will service that intake trains and particularly in trains. The Western Growth Corridor is another example of that. BT came out and said they're not going to do any more developmenting in that Western Growth Corridor in certain pockets because they're looking, you know, Australia, it has a mandate to build vibrant communities, and they said it's not conducive to vibrant communities because it doesn't have the livability there, you know, the green spaces, the public transport infrastructure. So, but if you look at Geelong, you know, you go a little bit further out, you've got the V line that goes directly into Melbourne, which makes it a faster train commuting from Geelong to Melbourne than it does from Werribee. But more importantly, four major government departments are now situated in Geelong. You know, Geelong was this sleepy two-story town, and now you've got these four massive glass bricks that are the ATO, NDIS, ABS, and WorkSafe, which is our work cover. So there's a very deliberate decentralisation policy coming from various levels of government that will inject a lot of energy into Geelong, Ballarat and Bendigo and take the heat out of Melbourne a little bit. So policies like that mean that Geelong it has now a lot more fundamentals than it's pretty much ever had, and it's a changing economy now that, you know, Ford has moved out and a lot of manufacturing has moved out of Geelong. But they've moved in really quickly to help absorb some of that unemployment. And coupled with, you know, really good roads, very flat roads, six-lane highways, a beautiful coastline in, you know, Ocean Grove and Torquay, a great, you know, really good infrastructure, lots of new schools, lots of new subdivisions that are building, retail and education. That's a really, really good story. And our clients who invested in Geelong 2 years ago have done exceptionally well because of that. So that's a really good example of how, you know, you might view Geelong as being a sub-value type of property, a region compared to Melbourne, but in actual fact, the gains in Geelong have been much greater than Melbourne in the last few years.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, thanks for that example. Having grown up in Geelong, I'm happy to hear anyone say something kind about Geelong.
Yeah,
it's
always interesting to
people
who are from Geelong, they go, what?
And middle of winter is not the best time to praise its all the living of Geelong. But but I guess taking a step, I've got a few other areas I want to sort of direct this to, but I guess maybe to give you a bit of a give you a chance to sort of show your wares without giving it all away as well, is what are the areas you're actually looking to avoid at the moment? So which are the sort of key cities or key regions of cities that are that you think are most dangerous at this point?
Darwin, Perth, Adelaide, Hobart. Very easy.
Okay. Yep. And a little bit more background to that.
So just a really good way to have a think about diversified economies, right, is thinking about mining towns. Okay, mining towns are highly speculative. Yeah, you can get in and out quickly and make a lot of money, but it's not a strategy that we ever recommend. So if you look at the difference between, say, investing in Perth and Brisbane, they're both capital cities that have strong drivers from mining. But a very big difference between the two is that Perth is largely driven by only a couple of mines. It doesn't have that diversification within mining. And as soon as there's a drop in resources, Perth is on its knees. And we've seen that in the last cycle. Okay, Brisbane is propped up by 30, 40 different types of mining, not to mention many different mines within those classes. So when Clive Palmer closes his nickel mine, Townsville is on its knees. Townsville has double the unemployment rate in Australia right now than anywhere else. But Brisbane barely notices it because it's not driven primarily by nickel mining. So when that just gives you a really good example of how we look at economies. Until Perth starts investing heavily in health and education infrastructure, which are really the hallmarks of any modern economy in the world, I cannot see that improving. It has had some investment in that. I'm not saying that it's just relying on mining entirely. In fact, mining's not even the largest employer anymore. It just is very unstable because of the impact of mining in that city. Darwin's similar. Darwin has had a couple of good infrastructure projects. If the American military goes ahead and builds a base there and has that huge injection of population, then that could be a really good story for Darwin as well. So that's something that we're looking at the moment. At the end of the day, a really simple way to think of it is new jobs drive population, and population drives demand. But then you're also looking at wages growth in Australia, right? And that is a big issue. That has got to be one of the biggest reasons why these cities are not growing in the way that they typically should.
Yeah, and that sort of segues into the next sort of part that we're sort of I guess very focused on that whole wages growth and unemployment side of it, because that's where we see the dangers in the Australian economy at the moment is there's obviously the whole apartment construction has got a much longer lead time and lag time to normal building, in that it obviously takes a few years to get your project up, and then once you're actually building, it takes a lot longer to build your set of apartments. So we're really starting to see construction jobs coming off now, sort of based on downturns from 6 to 12 months ago. What are you seeing on the construction side? In terms of, do you look at people who are borrowing to build, or are you involved in that period? And can you give us any tips?
Yeah, I think it's actually broader than that. I think that we've had a couple of decades now of the casualisation of the workforce in Australia, and that is really unstable for people. It's much harder to borrow money if you're a casual. If you're on probation, when you're not investing in your people, you're not offering them the opportunities to really get engaged in the workforce and in companies, then you encourage this constant movement and a lack of loyalty that is a big issue for employers, you know, as well as it is for employees. But the casualisation of the workforce, I think, is a really key issue. And I think then, you know, as I said, the wages growth, you know, business not investing is another massive issue, particularly not investing in its people. So it's not for me just about construction jobs. If anything, I think construction jobs, when you look at the subcontractor industry, banks are looking at that more favourably because it looks like, you know, you're always going to have a job, whether it's in construction or FIFO. So just a, you know, just an example with that, right, is Brisbane a couple of years ago looks like it was going to be the next, you know, the next golden city, had a little bit of an upswing and then it dropped again. And everyone's like, well, what happened? You know, the way I see it is that that actually coincided with when Brisbane had the upswing, there were a lot of FIFO workers who were losing their jobs in because of the resources downturn in WA and Northern Territory, and also outback Queensland, well, regional Queensland, and then flew into Brisbane to try to get those construction jobs, especially in, you know, subcontractor type trades. And then when iron ore rallied again and China was buying more iron ore from us, then all those jobs left again, and that sort of dropped the real growth that was happening in Brisbane. So I think that's, you know, that's what I love about macroeconomics, is really looking at how the effect of one thing can have an impact on so many other things.
Yep. But so in terms of the construction jobs,
yeah,
I guess there's a case to be made whether there are alternative roles for those people to move in to, and that's sort of, I might put that aside for 1 minute just to sort of say that though that within the construction industry, as these apartments are finishing up now, are you seeing any sort of lending growth or building growth at sort of at the grassroots level? I'm guessing probably more likely to be houses and you know, that will actually take up some of that slack, or is that area of the market still pretty quiet?
Yeah, I think I think the other thing you've got to look at is when banks crack down on lending, it's not just for investors, it's also for developers. You know, developers have had a really tricky time getting their money, you know, out of banks, and the banks are looking at more pre-sales and different conditions. So I know that developers have been going a lot more towards private funding and, alternative forms of lending than our big four banks. So I don't think that bodes particularly well for construction workers being able to go into a different part of, construction. Apartments aren't getting built. But I have to say there's still an enormous amount of cranes in the sky, especially with commercial and government building. In Sydney and Melbourne, we've had a lot of infrastructure put in. So I think that's probably helpful in terms of taking up the slack. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think there are a lot of house and there is a lot of house and land getting built, but I don't know that they would have enough jobs to take up the loss of jobs in the apartment sector.
Yeah, and you're not seeing, I guess, in terms of the lending side to developers, are you seeing that free up at all, or is it still pretty dire for them in terms of trying to find capital?
Yeah, I think it's still pretty grim. Yeah, I do. I think that the lending is starting to free up again for, you know, individuals, but I don't know that that's the case with commercial. I think that's going to take a little while to pick up.
Yep. And when you say individuals, investors as well as owner occupiers?
Yeah. So, you know, it's a bit easier for investors as well, especially for the investors who are owner occupiers and have equity in their homes. A lot of brokers that I deal with have been saying that they can't even get the equity out of people's homes to be able to invest in property. So that's starting to change. And also if you look at the interest rate between interest-only loans and principal and interest loans, they're much closer together than they were a year ago.
Right. And in terms of, obviously APRA went through that bit of the crackdown on the interest-only lending, and sort of our macro stats sort of seem to say that they were pretty successful at pulling that all back. Is any of that starting to reverse, or is it still pretty hard to get an interest-only loan for something new?
I think something that's more significant actually is the LVR requirement for investment loans. So, you know, when APRA was cracking down, it was much, much more difficult to get an investor loan at 90% LVR, and it had a higher rate if you wanted it to be interest-only as well. The way I kind of looked at it was, you know, you could go either 80% principal and interest, so 80% interest only or 90% principal and interest. And that was a way that the banks were, you know, kind of making things a little bit more certain, but it had a similar effect on the investor's ability to borrow money. So those two go hand in hand. And I think that there has been a drop. I'm not actually practicing as a mortgage broker, so I'm not writing loans every day and seeing this in effect, but I'm certainly starting to see a lot more investors come my way. So that would indicate to me that they're, you know, able to get more money out of the equity that they've already built in their homes, out of their pay packet, out of the banks. So Yep.
So the pressure is alleviating. And I guess the SMSF market, that's sort of one area you spoke about.
The SMSF market is still pretty grim. You know, and I don't think any of the major four are lending in the SMSF space anymore. It's much harder. It's much more expensive, and it's a much lower LVR requirement. And very, very postcode specific and not very lenient when it comes to new property. Some lenders are requiring that a property is a couple of years old before they'll lend on it through an SMSF. And I think that's a mistake. I really think that's a mistake. I mean, you know, when I talk about real wages growth, when I talk about wage, you know, employment certainty, we then have to look at the knock-on effect with superannuation and people's ability to self-fund their retirement. You know, the banks are the Parliament's, you know, talking at the moment about the pension and what's going to happen to the pension, what's going to happen to the pension age. Allowing people to use their own money to self-fund, which is essentially what an SMSF does, you know, it just makes really, really good sense to me. I really don't understand why, you know, governments will crack down on that.
You'll get a lot of pushback from us on that. We're not big fans of taking all your eggs and sticking them in one basket, I guess. So that's, and I think probably in the better cases, in the bigger SMSFs, I think there's a case for it. I think our concern and the things that we see is we see the smaller people who turn up with, you know, $100,000 get talked into sticking, you know, $200,000 or $300,000 mortgage onto it. All these fees get ripped out and thrown into a brand new apartment with some huge sales commission sold to a mixture of the people who also set up the SMSF and put them into this. And I think that's where the danger is, that the losses you can get from at the smaller end outweigh the benefits you might get in some of the people at the larger end.
Yeah, sure. I think that's true of anything though, isn't it? I mean, if it's set up correctly with credible people who have who are looking at a diversification strategy with the fund that's able to support that, I think it's a good idea.
Yeah. Well, I'll say at least for both of us, it's a good thing because, you know, being credible people in your industry with a lot of, you know, there are a lot of discreditable people in the property industry. There's also obviously a lot in the finance industry, so as the Royal Commission showed straight up. So,
yeah,
so hopefully both of us benefit from that.
yeah, for sure.
So Susan, just a quick one, and we'll maybe just use that as a bit of a segue into, and I'll get your thoughts on perhaps some of the quality assurance issues that the apartment market in particular has sort of been experiencing, and it seems to be sort of quite focused in Sydney and also a bit now in Melbourne.
Yeah.
But before I do, I just wanted to get maybe a bit of insight on going back to that, you know, fantastic research sort of methodology that you employ.
Yeah.
Just to get an idea of, we've got an idea of, say, location and, you know, the various sort of macro and microeconomic sort of principles that pick out, say, Geelong, for example, on those factors you mentioned.
Yeah.
Do you then go the next step and say, this is the style of property that matches those key criteria, if you will. So, let's say, for example, an apartment over a house with a big backyard, over a, you know, a brand new house, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in Sydney, I talk about, you know, look at the difference between Surry Hills and Pennant Hills. You know, Surry Hills is, you know, in a city, on the city fringes, trendy. You know, like, people are going to value walking to the pub, walking to good restaurants, being able to walk to work or cycle to work, good public transport, compared to the suburbs that are very family oriented. But you really want to be investing in a mansion that is close to big arterial roads and big schools. Everything's focused around kids. You know, massive Westfield, or, you know, similar, with undercover parking, or wet weather parking, big parks, you know, all of that kind of thing. So really getting into the heads of who is going to be renting this property. And then, yeah, obviously getting cash flow on that. But, yeah, in terms of the quality stuff, you know, it's just horrendous what's going on at the moment. We would, firstly, in our model, we never recommend those types of apartment blocks. We look at, say, 10 to 30 apartments within a boutique apartment development, and none of them in the city, you know, but sort of two to five Ks out, you know, like, none of them in the CBD. Those massive towers are, look, it's not so much that they're massive towers. Massive towers can get built really well, but this model of the private certifier is just the chunkiest thing. And I know that the Berejiklian government in New South Wales is really committed to fixing that through legislation by the end of the year. And hopefully you've got a similar government that's going to crack down on that.
Yeah, and I'm guessing, from a macro point of view, that seems as if that's just one more thing that's probably going to slow that whole apartment market down.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, there's regulation coming, you know they're talking about it. Why would I start a $100 million project without actually seeing the black and white and what's going to be required?
Yeah, and the irony of that, though, is in Sydney, if you look at the population statistics, we're going to run out of dwellings in about a year and a half. You know, if you look at our natural population compared to the death rate with interstate migration, which for Sydney is negative, but overseas migration, which is overwhelmingly positive, we're not going to have enough supply in about a year and a half. So, you know, then what? Then, you know, again, the clock pushes up, you've got that, you know, scarcity, that capital growth, you know, and then we go all over again. So, and then there are, again, real issues with affordability, with first homeowners, et cetera. So, yeah, it's interesting times, you know. I think it's a very interesting cycle to be a part of.
Yes. And so the other one, there's obviously demand from overseas, and in particular China, sort of helped drive the prices up sort of 4 or 5 years ago. And there's certainly a lot I guess there's two sides to this now from our perspective. Is one is we're looking at China's cracking down on its capital account and trying to prevent money from going overseas. Three parts to that. There's obviously some foreign investor taxes and things like that that have been put on. But also we've got all the problems going on in Hong Kong that sort of you would think would be encouraging people from Hong Kong to buy elsewhere and to at least, you know, make sure they had their somewhere to go or some of their assets sort of offshore. The net effect of that, are you seeing sort of growth in that foreign demand still, or are you seeing?
Yeah. So the whole Chinese market changed enormously. The penalties for FIRB stamp duty and the amount of FIRBs being approved definitely dropped. So just for your listeners, for an apartment block, an apartment block has to seek Foreign Investment Review Board approval before it can sell to foreigners, and that's not just Chinese, that's any foreigner. And now if you are a foreigner, the stamp duty levy is significant. So it dissuades investors from investing in Australia. Part of the push from China came when Canada did exactly the same thing a few years ago. So, the research that we have done on the regions that China values, It was America first, Canada second, and Australia third. And then when Trump came in, they were more likely to go for Canada. And then Canada did a very similar thing where they made stamp duty for foreign investors much, much more expensive. And that pushed a lot more Chinese investors into Australia where they may not have otherwise done that. So that's what was happening in the, you know, the growth cycle, the growth quadrant of the last cycle. That has dropped significantly, but now we are seeing, or it's I haven't seen it yet, but it is speculated that there is going to be much more of a push out of Hong Kong, where Hong Kong investors, A, that are in Chinese as well, Chinese mainlanders who are in Hong Kong are copying it right now from the protesters. There was a massive altercation last night in two parts of Hong Kong between, Hong Kong and the mainlanders without, where they were bashing each other with sticks, and there was not a policeman to be seen. So that's going to cause a lot of tension on Hong Kong in itself. So I imagine that the Chinese who are in Hong Kong may want to look at getting out, and definitely Hong Kong people living in Hong Kong are just very scared of this legislation that means that they could be prosecuted in China.
Yeah, sure. And obviously, expats, there's lots of expats there. So I guess but to date, the foreign investor is still a net negative for the property market. They haven't seen that actually turn around yet.
I'm not entirely sure. I haven't seen any difference with my company because my investors are typically, busy Sydney professionals with a smattering of other people around Australia. And I don't have very many Chinese or Asian investors at all. I'm mostly, just kind of typical Aussie. I haven't really seen that in my business, and I haven't run many statistics on it because it's not particularly relevant to my business
either. Yeah, sure. So I guess it's more, you'd probably see competition in for apartments, I suppose, is where.
Yeah, and as I said, apartments aren't really a big part of my business. Mostly I'm looking at house and land and townhouse, boutique townhouse development. So, I don't know whether that's the case, but I can imagine that, again, looking at a global macro perspective, what's happening at the moment, and then you also look at the trade wars between China and America, what effect is that going to have as well? Even though there is a crackdown on getting money out of China, there might be more of a push to do that or to do that, to do that illegally. Certainly worthwhile. I mean, I think it's a fairly healthy speculation.
Okay, sure. I think it's quite telling there, given the breadth of your experience in the property market, that you've decided to sort of emit in a way the large-scale apartment buildings. And I think we somewhat feel the same there as an investment option. In summation, how can our reader and watching viewer base get in touch with you and get a bit of an idea about what you do and follow your work there, Susan?
Oh. Thanks for asking that. You can Google either Susan Farquhar or Calla Property. So that's Calla Property. We are at Martin Place in Sydney, and my website explains a lot of what I do, and you can see all of the awards and the media stuff that I've done. Or you can contact me directly at susan@callaproperty.com.au. Or give me a call. My phone number's on the website as well. So they're probably the best ways to get in touch with me. I'm more than happy to help your investors and your listeners, invest wisely in Australian residential property.
Excellent. Thanks, Susan.
Fantastic. All right. Thanks very much. So, Damien, a terrific 50-odd minutes spent there with Susan Farquhar, Director of Calla Property, a person with some fantastic insights into her couple of decades of experience in the Australian property market. In particular, of note for mine was the depth of her research methodology into the way that she determines primary areas for her investors to look at when purchasing property. But what were your thoughts?
Yeah, certainly. And I think, you mentioned as well just after the interview, she's got sort of, a focus on looking for quality and looking for value with a macro overlay, which is very similar to our investment process in stocks. And I think that's something we'll certainly explore with her in later interviews. But, the key thing for this one was getting a view on the cycle and where we are. I think we have different views of the cycle, but in terms of the longer term picture, but I think on the shorter term basis, we're probably on a similar basis. And it was good to hear her sort of confirming some of the thoughts we had on the short term signals. So I guess in our perspective, we're going through this property downturn. And we've had a new government elected, and they've thrown everything they can at trying to stop the property downturn from progressing any further, and sort of hold things where they are.
Yep.
It does seem as if that's holding, and a lot of the statistics she sort of, and what she's seeing on the ground was sort of showing that. The big issue is if there's any sort of external shock, or you get a big lift in unemployment as construction comes off, then that's where we've already used most of our ammunition, just trying to hold the bubble, from preventing it from deflating too far. And if we do get the external shock, you know, there's a significant negative downside is what I'm looking at from the risk return. So I guess from the upside doesn't seem to be a lot. There seems to be a lot of downside in those negative scenarios. But sort of coming back to where she's and what she's saying about current conditions is, it does seem as if things are holding, despite the fact Chinese demand is still down. SMSF seems like it's pretty much taken out of the equation now. Yep. There is still some lending constraints, but they are freeing up, and so I think it's we're not really back to a boom time, but I think considering that external shock that the housing market is going to hold where it is for a little while before we see the next sort of phase of whether there's a renewed push of debt in Australia, which seems unlikely, but it's the current government seems to be quite committed to trying to convince Australians to borrow ever more.
Yep, fair enough.
Versus the negative downturn, and whether that sort of wipes away those effects. So net, we're sort of sticking with our view, but I think it was certainly some valuable insights we got from Susan about the on the ground behaviour and what she's seeing and also some sort of valuable tips in terms of the idea that you do need diversified economies and the small towns that might get you the greatest gains because they're focused on one industry are also the ones that give you the greatest losses when you have problems.
That was quite revealing. Yeah, absolutely. And we certainly look forward to getting you back on the show in the not too distant future and get an update. Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe, give us your email address, and in return we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.